Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Cynthia Dearen, and this is the Business Beyond Borders podcast. I created this show to inspire and motivate entrepreneurs and business owners who want to expand their company internationally and make a bigger impact on the world. My guest today is Skander Malcolm, the Managing Director and CEO at OFX, which is a listed foreign exchange company that started in a garage on Sydney's northern beaches around 20 years ago by a guy called Matt Gilmore. Today, Skander heads up what has become a public company with an ambitious global agenda. Skander has more than 23 years' experience in financial services, including payments technology platforms in both established and emerging markets, and he's held some senior roles in big corporates. As the president and CEO of GE Capital, Skander led a team of more than 4,500 employees to deliver sustainable growth and operational excellence. While he was at GE, he also facilitated GE's largest ever volunteer donation to OzHarvest and bolstered participation in employee volunteering by 40%. Skander also launched the UK's first and largest digital personal loan business, Hamilton Direct Bank, which grew to more than £3 billion in its first 5 years. Today, we're going to be talking about his journey and about his work at OFX. Skander, welcome to the Business Beyond Borders podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
So we're going to talk today about OFX, which you currently run, but let's start with how you spend your spare time, because you can't be a CEO of a global company every single minute of the day, can you?
That's right. No, and I think what makes being a CEO possible is I've got a wonderful family. So my wife, Sarah, and I've got two kids. Daughter Alice is about to turn 13, and a son, Felix. So, you know, we kind of hang out, and we just moved back to Australia a couple of years back. So we're enjoying a lot of family time, doing all the things that families do.
That's great. So when you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up? I mean, was running an international business always on the cards for you, or was there some other dream that you had as a youngster?
I certainly never thought I was going to run an international business. I didn't even know what an international business was, although my father kind of did international business. No, I think when I was a kid, I really wanted to play in the AFL, or the VFL as it was then. And then later on, I think I wanted to be a fireman for some reason. I fancied the idea of driving around in those big fire trucks and, you know, climbing up tall buildings and all that good stuff. But, yeah, ended up running an international business.
So how did you get there? What did you do when you left school?
So I took a year out between school and university, and I kind of traveled, and I did some time at a school in England as well. So I did sort of 6 months there, studied. And then I traveled for kind of 6 months, and I got a bit of a taste for what it was like to live overseas. Came back, did university here in Australia, and then when I finished, which was 1989, I then sort of took off. I had a British passport, so thought I'll just go and live in the UK for a couple of years and then come back to Australia. But I ended up staying in the UK and the US for about 11 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And were you working then, or studying, or doing some combination of both?
No, just working. And I started off doing a very simple job serving customers in a consumer finance company in a very unfashionable part of London. And I just took to it. I loved it. It was kind of hard work. I learned a lot about serving customers, keeping it real, you know, literally the basics of finance. And I did various roles with that company for about 11 years. I went to the US for a year, did a sort of general management program in the US, which was just a ton of fun. Back to the UK, ended up running one of their businesses. And then right when I was at the point of thinking, well, I'm going to stay overseas for probably my entire career, my now wife said, let's go and live in Australia. So I left the UK and we came back to Australia.
And have you been here ever since?
No. So I did a couple of years at Westpac, which was good fun. And then I went down to Melbourne and joined GE. And I was with GE until 2000 and around about the end of 2012. And I got a visit from the lady who was running human resources at the time, a lady by the name of Susan Peters. And she kind of said, well, what do you want to do next? And I said, well, we're mobile as a family, so if there's any overseas stints, we'd be interested. And she said, would you live and work in Istanbul? And I thought, gee whiz, I don't know. I said, I'll have to check with my wife.
Good answer.
Yeah, exactly. And luckily we were both sort of keen to try that. So we went and lived over there for 3 years, and I had an amazing job. I was looking after GE Healthcare, and I was running a region where there were 84 different countries from Russia, Central Asia, Turkey, Middle East, and Africa.
So tell me about some of the challenges that came up for you as you were doing that role, because I know that you had lived in the UK and you lived in the US, and I'm sure there were some challenges there, but those are places that are much, much more similar to home than Istanbul, and then running 84 countries. So, I mean, what was that like?
It was a lot of fun. I mean, it certainly was challenging because I was going from financial services. So I was running GE Capital, and then the new role was running a region for GE Healthcare. So I was switching industries, and that was a real challenge because you're moving from, you know, marketing and risk management and, you know, financial services into, you know, deep science, healthcare, precision medicine. You know, we did a bit of work around public-private partnerships with healthcare, with countries, with nations, so that helped. But shifting industries was the first challenge because you really had to go back to first principles, and I don't even have any kind of scientific background. The second one was, you know, the language. And so I didn't speak Turkish or Arabic or Russian or any of the African languages. So trying to understand what people were talking about, culturally trying to relate to their context and sort of understand what their kind of key drivers were. That was the second one. And then thirdly, just the people on the team were all completely new to me. You know, they were all good executives, but they had, you know, completely different habits from people who were in financial services, very long cycle business, as I said, scientific. So really those were the big three, you know, different cultural context and language, different industry and different people on the team, yeah.
And so if there was a key lesson that you learned from that role and from dealing with that level of complexity, what was it? And how did that set you up for what came next later on down the track with OFX?
Well, I learned a very important lesson, which is that I thought I was a good listener, but it's not until you sort of strip away everything that you're familiar with and you really have to very actively listen to learn that I learned that you know, that very active listening is such a critical part of being an executive or running your own business, really paying attention to what customers are saying, paying attention to what data you can get a hold of, paying attention to all those nuances that you might take for granted if you've been in the same industry or the same country for a very long time. And when I say active listening, I really mean listening, paying attention, and actually respecting the lessons that you've got to learn. I think that was really the number one lesson for me that has really helped, you know, as I've taken on the OFX role back in financial services, but a new part of financial services, very global business, new team, it's a public company. So a lot of things for me to learn, and that active listening has been a big part of, you know, succeeding, as it were.
So let's talk a bit about OFX now. And you're not the founder, and primarily what I do on this show is that I often interview founders who've started a business and then taken it to another country or turned it into a global business, because they're often the people who can speak best to that. But obviously, once a company gets to a certain size and it becomes listed, it's frequently not the founder who is actually in the driver's seat anymore. And so you're really here today. One of the reasons I wanted you on the show is because you're now the person leading the charge on the OFX global expansion. But I would like to sort of get you to speak on behalf of the founder, as it were, in a way, because OFX started as a very small company, as I understand it, maybe in somebody's garage on the northern beaches of Sydney more than 20 years ago, and it's gone on to become very successful. So can I get you on behalf of the founder to kind of share that story with us? And you know, tell me, how did OFX get started and what was that all about?
Sure. Well, actually, the founder is a guy by the name of Matt Gilmore. And completely coincidentally, Matt and I were at uni together, so we're friends. And in fact, when I was thinking about joining the company, I was desperate to speak to him. But of course, Matt's still a shareholder in the company, so I couldn't, which was very frustrating. I asked the chairman, look, I know Matt, can I bring him up? And he said, no, we can't do that. But look, you know, Matt had always had this very kind of customer-centric approach. He was in institutional foreign exchange for Bankers Trust. And I mean, talking to Matt once I joined the company about what was behind OFX or AusForex as it was then, he said, look, just really simply, I was providing this amazing service for institutional clients on foreign exchange and, you know, at a very, very sharp price. And then there were all these small and mid-sized businesses and consumers who just weren't getting the same service or the same price. And so really the idea came from, I wonder why we can't provide that. There's no one out there doing this for small businesses and consumers. And that's really what Matt's original sort of inspiration was. And to your point, it started in his garage in DY, and Matt really built it into, started really with more of an information portal to help people understand the market and how it worked. And then he started getting licenses in order to operate actual transactions. And he brought in a partner, Gary Lord, and they really built the business together. They went international in about 2003, started in New Zealand, and then the UK. We built up licenses subsequently, you know, all across the United States. Hong Kong, we've got an office. We literally just opened an office in Singapore on April the 1st. But the same philosophy and the inspiration was all around Matt's view that customers can get a better deal. And it really, as he says, you know, very openly, the development of the World Wide Web and the internet really accelerated the ability for us to do this all around the world.
Yeah.
But the fundamentals have remained. Can you help customers get a better deal?
So as the CEO now, what's your vision for, you know, for making the company even more global than it already is?
Well, there's three areas that I think we can help grow the company. The first one is true to Matt's vision. I still think we can improve the client experience. Today, we have, you know, over 160,000 active clients, over a million clients who use us on a regular basis, and we still think we can improve the service. Whether it's a better app, better website, you know, simpler features, better price. There's lots of things that we can do to continue to improve the client experience. And we think, although we have tremendous advocacy from our clients and former clients, we can still make that better. And frankly, the competition, in our view, has really raised the bar on how to make things simple or better information. And so, you know, we need to continue to innovate around client experience. The second one is really around partnerships. And the big change, I think, in business today for small businesses compared to when Matt started the company was you can use partners like Amazon Web Services or Google or, you know, alliance partners like NerdWallet, and they can help you really grow your business. Amazon, you know, in an online marketplace today allows you to kind of be immediately global.
Yes.
And that is really where we want to continue to build our growth. Not just commercial partnerships, and we certainly are working with some big companies and governments indeed on how to, you know, provide services to bigger companies. For example, we do, if you're a Google employee and you live in the UK, and you have Google stock, when you sell that stock and you want to take your US dollars and convert them back to pound sterling, it's actually OFX that does that for all Google employees anywhere around the world. And there's actually a couple of other large companies. We do it for Amazon, believe it or not. We do it for PayPal. So these large companies and partnerships we want to do more of. But also, how do we operationally and in technology sense partner up with companies to continue to grow? Look, I think the final thing is geographically, as you touched on earlier on, we still want to do more in different parts of the world. And the two geographies where we believe we can particularly accelerate our growth, one is North America, and so that's both the US and Canada. We have 47 licenses across the US because you need state licenses as well as federal. We can operate in 50 states. And so we want to take those licenses and do more, particularly in the small and mid-sized business space, but also with consumers, and really grow our North American business. And then the other one is really in Asia. And we've got a really good business in Hong Kong. We've opened up an office in Singapore. Really there, what we do very well is what we call the online sellers. So again, if you're a small business working with Amazon or Etsy or Rakuten, we have a product which we call a global currency account, which allows you to pay suppliers, receive funds at a much, much better rate than the incumbent providers. And customers love it. We're growing very, very fast. And there's big growth in online selling in Asia. So those are the three areas where we're focused.
And what kind of strategies are you using to target those markets that you're going into? I mean, are you selecting certain sectors or types of businesses? Are you using certain channels of marketing? What does that picture look like?
Yeah, so we've actually just spent about a year developing very deep insights on the consumer side of our business to understand customer segments, what they prefer. And we've developed a kind of market map, if you like, of five segments that have different needs. And we've selected the segments that we like, that we think we can serve. And so we're very particular about targeting people who value, for example, a very competitive price, great service, as well as trust, a trusted provider. Those are the three things. So we're not really, for example, in the remittance space, you know, high volume, small payments.
Yeah.
Typically, our transactions are much larger transactions where the client really values being able to speak to someone on the phone. If anything goes wrong, they can sort it out 24/7. That's what we do. And it's pretty similar in all of those markets.
Yeah.
It does vary a bit by geography, but those are the kind of core things that we target on the consumer side. Then on the smaller mid-sized business, these are businesses who are generally exporters, and they're across a whole range of different industries, actually. But what they tend to value, again, is they want a very competitive price, and the banks are typically around anywhere between 3%, 4%, 5% to exchange, plus fees, whereas we're more like 1% or less. Secondly, great service. And again, because we have 24/7 service and our teams are actually in country, so in Hong Kong, in San Francisco, in Toronto, in London, in Sydney, they can resolve those queries for small businesses and mid-sized businesses there on the spot. And then the other area in our small and mid-sized business that I mentioned before is online sellers.
Yeah.
So those small businesses that are going online and selling through those marketplaces, that product that we've developed and that service that supports it, are really the core areas that we're targeting.
So you've really niched down to a few specific customer profiles or avatars where I'm assuming you've seen a blank space in the market and really targeted those rather than, for example, going to head-to-head with a potential competitor who does remittances, for argument's sake.
Well, it's really interesting because it sounds, the way I describe it, like it's niche, but it's actually, to give you an idea, there's about $138 trillion of money being moved around. There's about $200 billion of revenue that throws off from that.
Yes.
And then in those targets that I'm talking about, it's about $60 billion of revenue that we're in there competing with, and our revenue last year was about 110 million. So there's a lot of revenue there.
Yes.
But what I'd also say is it's very crowded. In the last 5 years, we've seen about 7,000 new entrants in 5 years.
Oh, across how many countries?
Oh, that's globally. And basically what's driving that is more and more consumers and more businesses now are global.
Yeah.
You know, you're moving around the world a lot. Your business is, you're sourcing things from all around the world. You're selling all around the world. And so this cross-border piece is just getting bigger and bigger.
And as you have gone into these new markets, I think you mentioned Hong Kong, mm-hmm. Singapore.
Yep.
Somewhere else?
Well, those... Singapore is the most recent one,
yes.
Hong Kong, London before that,
yes.
North America before that.
My question was really going to be, what have you found most challenging about opening in those different new markets?
Look, I think there's a couple of things. One is you've really got to understand what either consumers or small businesses value and who you're competing with in those markets. You can't do that from Sydney. You have to go there and understand those particular places. And so there's a bit of a challenge if you're not there to actually go there and understand it. I'd say the second thing is finding the right leadership.
Yeah.
You know, finding, for example, the right leader in North America. You know, when I arrived in the business, we had a leader there, but she was doing the role kind of part-time. We wanted to get a new leader. So it took us about sort of 4 to 5 months and a lot of interviews to find the person that we felt was big enough to do that expansion. I'm in the process of finding a new leader in London. You know, that is so crucial because at the end of the day, they're your person on the ground. They're the one that myself and the board are investing significant capital on behalf of shareholders in. So I think one is understanding customers locally and the other is finding the right leader. Those are the two big ones.
And how different have you found the customers from place to place? I mean, are expectations similar across the board or are there very particular preferences, you know, between Hong Kong and London or San Francisco or wherever it's going to be?
They are a bit different. The interesting one to me, the revelation to me has been really around in the US. I kind of figured they would be similar to Australians or British, but actually hardly any Americans are sending money overseas as a proportion of all Americans, which is very different to Australians who nearly all have some experience in it. And so they're actually used to paying quite high fees. They don't even realize in many cases that other countries don't accept US dollars.
Right.
So even the idea of foreign exchange is a bit foreign to some of them. And so you're having to do a lot more education on what foreign exchange is. They wouldn't have a clue that actually, okay, they just assume that you can use your US dollars in Malaysia or Europe or wherever. So explaining that you're going to have to switch the money across and that there's a fee and what the price is and how you do this, it's really quite different to, say, UK or Hong Kong or Australia. That's just one example. The small businesses, though, in the US are increasingly very marketplace-driven, and they are probably leading the world in saying, look, I can trade anywhere in the world now and I just need to be with Amazon or with eBay or with Etsy or someone like that.
Yeah.
And so they're developing their understanding. But the US banking system is nothing like as sophisticated as, say, even the Australian banking system or the UK banking system for providing those services. So there's a great opportunity for us.
And what do you think it was? And this is a slightly different tack, but I mean, I'm just thinking back to the fact that OFX started in a garage in DY on Sydney's northern beaches. What has been the X factor which has let this company turn into a listed global player in 20 years? Because that is not something that your average garage startup can do.
True. Look, I think there's a couple of things. I think the first thing is throughout its history, and it hasn't always been great, it's had this unwavering focus on the customer.
Yeah.
And look, when everything else goes wrong, if you're serving customers really well, you've got a game. You know, you're going to be in some way competitive. We've made our share of mistakes, no question, over that 20 years. But I think the customers have shown a lot of loyalty because they've received a great service.
Yeah.
I think there's been a good level of ability to say what's happening next as well. Mm. I mean, OFX really was doing this kind of fintech 15 years ago before fintech was kind
a
of
thing.
A thing. And it tried things, it took risks. And I think, again, if you're starting up a company, obviously you have to start to take a few risks, mm-hmm. but never risks that we're going to sink the entire company.
Yes.
And also that I'd say the third thing is it's really learned from its mistakes. And yeah. we did make mistakes. You know, we rely very much on banking partners. We use the banking system. And at one point, you know, we lost the support of a major bank, and it turned out we had a lot of exposure to that banking partner. And to the credit of the team at the time, they said, gee whiz, we never want to be in that position again. Mm. So we've now got a banking panel of about 16 banks that support us, so that if one bank, you know, for whatever reason doesn't like us anymore, we're covered and our clients will, yes. you know, will complete. So I think taking risks, customer first, learning from your mistakes. It all sounds very obvious. We've had luck too. You know, there's been things that we've frankly just been pretty lucky with. I think we coincided with a tremendous boom in the internet, which made going global a lot easier. Mm. And I think secondly, we've been lucky in that we've had good people really for a very long time, and that's helped us.
Now, you mentioned that fintech was not a thing 15 years ago. Given that fintech is now very much probably the thing, where do you see foreign exchange and the way that that works going, you know, over the next 20 years? What is it going to be sort of more of the same, or do you think there's going to be some massive shift that's going to change everything again?
Look, it's a fascinating question, and we talk about it as a leadership team and as a board, and we've done various scenarios that we think could happen.
Yeah.
But the interesting conclusion that we get to is that if you believe those segmentation studies, what you're seeing is that there's a sort of segment that values service, reassurance, you know, licensed, highly trusted, you know, providers. Okay. Then there's a segment that is increasingly saying, look, I could care less who does this for me. And, you know, for small value transactions, moving money, it's digital, it should just happen. And I don't care that much if I don't know the provider. I just want it done quickly.
Yeah.
It's got to be purely digital. So I think over time, those companies with very large customer bases, probably, you know, the famous ones, the Facebooks and the Googles, also potentially, you know, some of these Chinese players with very large customer bases who can move and exchange small amounts very, very quickly will end up dominating the small payments and remittance sort of sector.
Yeah.
And then probably there'll be a group of people who are known for their, you know, high service delivery, high trust, who will probably take care of the larger transactions. And then there'll always be banks who kind of, in my mind, kind of run the infrastructure of, you know, provide certainty. And we'll see definitely more speed in the system. So today, you know, sometimes it can take 3 days, sometimes it's a day. I'm sure that within a few years it'll be, everything will be within a day, if not an hour, if not instantly. Customers will drive that preference for speed, but that certainty will also continue to be a factor. You might be comfortable sending, you know, $200 where you don't care too much who the provider is, but would you send $200,000 with someone you've never heard of?
No, probably not.
Right. So.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I want to ask you a question about the culture of OFX, and I was curious to know what you think defines a great corporate culture for an international company.
Mm-hmm.
And I also wondered how you go about creating that, you know, as you move out of the garage and onto the global stage. What do you do? How do you create something and then keep it running consistently?
Well, I think culture, first of all, is a moving thing. I think there are certain things that remain, as it were, critical that you will always try and foster. And, you know, for us, it's always been a learning culture. We've never known all the answers. We got into this in a way that, you know, we were literally inventing the fintech space. We were figuring out global as we went. But we weren't afraid to try, and we were quite prepared to learn from our mistakes. So I think that's that. We call it always learning. And that you can stick that slogan on the wall, but to your question, how are you driving your executives and your teams to say, when was the last time you learned something? When was the last time we really tried something a little different here? And you sort of got to build that into your literally your daily meetings. You know, what are we learning? What's the new thing that helps us continue to evolve? I'd say the second thing is we've been Aus4x, we've been OFX, we've been a private company, we've been a public company. We've had, you know, different leadership over the years, over the 20 years. But I think the thing that I've found meeting people who've worked for the company 20 years ago to today is there's always been respect for each other.
Yeah.
And it's not the brand. It's not, you know, whether I'm the CEO or someone else. It's each other. The promises people keep, the promises that they make to each other that we're going to get this done. And I think OFX has really succeeded in that respect. There's always been a good, can-do, we-do-it-for-each-other mentality. And I think finally, as we've gone global, although we've been doing it for some time, I'd say we're really becoming more of a global company now, putting bigger leaders into these global roles, defining much bigger investments in our global businesses. We're actually working out how do you share ideas, how do you move fast in North America but not let Sydney slow you down, how do you develop a European strategy that Sydney can get comfortable with, you know, how do you be Asian, and that's something that we're very much learning now. I wouldn't say we've kind of cracked a code. We just say, look, it's about respect and customers and figuring out and learning. But we're still figuring out how to be a great global company.
I'm going to check back with you in a couple of years' time on that one.
Sure.
Now, Skander, being the chief in a listed business is a really big gig. But I am also curious to know, apart from the fact that you have a board to report to and, you know, you have a listed company that kind of cares whether you're there, what is it that gets you out of bed in the morning? I mean, what keeps you motivated to keep showing up to do this big gig?
Yeah, again, it sounds very trite, but honestly, it's the people that I work with. I've really been amazed joining the company at, I kind of see people, we're not a startup, we're a scale-up.
Yeah.
And I see a lot of people who've come from the startup phase of the company who have got incredible enthusiasm, who are so hungry to learn, you know, how it is to run a bigger company and how it is to run a global company. And so to your question, that's stuff that I've done. And I honestly get a lot of energy sitting in a room full of people saying, okay, how are we going to make Singapore an office that we can be proud of? How are we going to develop our North American strategy and our product and tech teams? How are we going to bring this global currency account to life in different ways? And they're very much learning and developing. And honestly, I get a lot of energy out of seeing people develop into those kind of leaders. And they oftentimes haven't had any of the benefits that I've had of a lot of great corporate education and experience. They're just enthusiastic. And for me, it's kind of about how do you help them be much better than they thought they could be.
I like that. I like that a lot. Mm. Now, a leadership role has lots of highs, but it also has some pretty tough bits in it. And I always ask this question of people who come on the show, because I think it can be really instructive for people who are also, you know, somewhere behind you on the path, but on the same journey. When you get into one of those rough patches, I don't know, a difficult situation blows up, or you've got a really hard decision to make, or you've been awake for the last couple of nights worrying about something that is going on with the business, what are your strategies for kind of getting out of that space? I mean, do you do laps around the block? Do you meditate? Do you have mentors who you go and talk to? What are the set of tools that you've developed over time for fixing those situations?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think people come at it from different perspectives. I'd love to hear some of the others. But the things that I've done over the years, What you're describing is resilience, that ability to bounce back, deal with setbacks. I think the first thing is understand that they're going to occur. Like, it is absolutely inevitable. Everyone in life is going to have good days and bad.
Yeah.
And you're going to have good news and bad news. And I don't care who you are. For me, it's about then saying there's certain things that, in essence, get me more frustrated than others. You know, if I feel someone's been disloyal, if I feel someone is acting for their purposes, not for the team, obviously when there's some kind of integrity breach, I really take that personally.
Yeah.
It's a trigger for me. But what I've learned is to sort of step back and try and get a sense of perspective. And that's actually where, candidly, that experience in Istanbul really helped, because I was traveling to parts of Africa and Russia and Central Asia where I saw people doing business in the Middle East in really appalling conditions. I mean, very, very tough conditions. And, you know, half the stuff that people worry about here, it's such a sort of first world issue compared to what they're really dealing with.
Yeah.
And so sometimes, you know, it's about stepping back and say, really, you know, are you going to get upset about that? And I know you are vested in that being a good outcome, but really, you know, the world is not going to end if the board don't get their paper in time, or someone has left the company who you didn't want to leave the company. And honestly, I physically believe there's a link. So I run, and I know that when I run, it clears my mind. I have, you know, when I was at times of stress in a role, I sometimes did just go for a walk, take a break, change the backdrop, clear your head.
Yeah.
You really have to manage yourself as a leader. And there's a price to pay for that. You know, you can't be someone who's so up and down all the time, because everyone else feels like, oh my goodness, how am I going to deal with scam today? You know, you have to try and be as even as you can. And sometimes that just means removing yourself from the situation. And again, I go back to the very start of our conversation that for me, you know, my family is a tremendous support network. It keeps it very real, you know, and that they see you with your best and your worst. They certainly don't think of you as their leader.
Dad, can I borrow the car?
Exactly. So that kind of helps as well.
Okay, that's there are some great insights right there. And it kind of that segues into what I wanted to ask you about around books. And I can see that you have made a note around books. So I'm also keen to find out, you know, what books, or, I mean, some people really don't like to read. So when I ask them about books, they say, I don't really read books. So I ask them about people. But I'll ask you about books.
Yep.
What books have you found game changing or inspirational for you on this journey? And what are they, and why? Why do you recommend them?
There's a few things. I mean, first of all, I think I happen to love literature. I've grown up reading books, and I kind of got that from my parents. There were books, one book when I was about 18 that, you know, had a very profound effect, even on my business career today, was Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. And it's about, you know, someone who essentially the metaphor is going up to, you know, the kind of origins of life, and he's actually trying to, you know, find this rogue business person, and that's what Apocalypse Now is based on. But read that book, because it gives you a good sense into human nature and what you're kind of grappling with, which in business sometimes you have to kind of confront.
That is the first time I've ever had that answer. So just tell me, what is the link between Heart of Darkness and the guy traveling up the Amazon in the boat and business for you? Where's
because
that connection?
Sometimes you are... you're going on a quest. You're going to build a business, for example, and you think, you know, the purpose of this is to build my business into a $10 million business, a $100 million business, a global business, whatever it is. And along that journey, you're actually figuring out stuff about yourself. I think particularly for small business and mid-sized business people, you're actually learning that the journey is just as important as any kind of financial goal. And that when you look inside yourself, it's kind of like, what actually matters?
Yeah.
You know, where does your energy, your authenticity really come from? You know by the end, you talk to most people who are at the end of that journey, and they say, you know, I don't remember the year I beat my business plan, I remember when this person I worked with, you know, developed themselves into this wonderful leader. That's the thing they remember. And that's what, in a sense, that book is about, is kind of that journey is what really matters, not finding Kurtz at the end of that, it's actually the Belgian Congo. So that book is a little bit about philosophy, much more practically. Two books that I've thought in business in the last sort of 10 years have been fascinating. One is The Lean Startup by Eric Ries. And I was lucky enough when I was at GE to meet Eric. And, you know, he is a small business startup guy who really fundamentally came up with a whole lot of different techniques that helped small business realize, you know, how to get things done quickly, to pivot if they needed to pivot. GE actually adopted a lot of those principles, if you can believe that. I mean, one of the largest companies in the world said, we need to be more like startups. And meeting Eric and hearing his philosophy about testing things, moving quickly, being clear about what your assumptions are so that you're learning against assumptions, I just thought was fascinating. Teams, how to get teams working together. So that was a very seminal book for me. The last one is a more recent book called The Content Trap. It's by Bharat Anand. And it's all about, in a digital world, how companies are falling into traps potentially, or taking advantage of communities to build very successful businesses. And I'm only halfway through that book, but I'm finding it absolutely fascinating about, you know, how digital operates, which companies have exploited communities in a very successful way versus those that haven't made those connections. So it's I'm learning a lot from that book too.
Those are some great tips. We will put the titles and the links to those books into the show notes for the episode so that people don't have to rewind in order to find them.
Right.
So, Skander, looking ahead, what is next for OFX? You know, where to from here?
Well, look, the people who run the company, the board, the people in the company are very excited because, you know, we have had a pretty tough couple of years and we're turning this business around. We're going to announce our results in about a week's time. So by the time this comes out, they may already be out. We're very positive on what we've been able to do, but we're even more excited about this opportunity to be more global, to continue to reinvent this client experience. I just think there's so many more things that we can learn about and do for small and mid-sized businesses, for consumers all around the world. And, you know, we think we can be a lot more global. It just is, this business is built for being global. There's not many Australian companies that have gone global. There's not many fintechs that have really succeeded globally. So we just want to be, you know, that company. We want to be that great Aussie global success story. And, you know, it's just so much fun. There's so much to do.
And what about for you? So, you know, what's next for Skander? Because for now, this is what you want to do. But is there some other dream that you have that you're going to pursue at some point in the future that doesn't have anything to do with foreign exchange?
Oh, for sure, at some point. But, you know, certainly not for the next couple of years. I'm loving what I do. The team, as I said, gives me a ton of energy. The fact that it's global gives me a ton of energy. And then, you know, at some point, obviously, there'll be other things that interest me. But for now, it's, you know, I couldn't be more, you know, excited, energized, getting on with trying to help people, you know, be great in the places we're at.
That's fantastic. So do you have some final thoughts for people listening to this episode, maybe in the micro to medium business space, thinking, I have this company and, you know, I think what we do is really great, but can I really turn this into an international company or into a global company? What do you say to people who are questioning themselves like that?
Well, I think be realistic because it isn't easy. But at the same time, it's where the world's moving. You know, your ability to be global is you can start quite you know, low risk these days by being, even if you're on an online marketplace.
Yeah.
And they can take the logistics risk away. You know, we can help you with a foreign currency risk. You can get companies that can help you with tax and so forth. So you don't have to master all that stuff right off the bat. And maybe you start to develop yourself, and then, yeah, you go and have a look at a few markets and you find some things that you think you can do well, and, you know, you find some people. I just think, to be honest, it's probably not going to be optional in about 10 years. If you're not global, there's going to be some other company operating here in Australia that is global, that's going to be trying to get to your customers.
Yeah.
So it's probably a skill. As I say to my team, you know, when I grew up, there weren't that many global companies. Today, in your career, you're probably, in fact, almost certainly going to have to develop your global skills. So you might as well embrace it and try.
I have to say, I am on the same page with you on that one. Scanner, it's been such a pleasure talking to you today. I really look forward to seeing where OFX goes next. And thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Hey, everyone. If you're enjoying the Business Beyond Borders podcast and you're thinking about expanding your company internationally, you might want to check out the International Business Accelerator, which is something I created to help micro to medium-sized businesses to speed up and de-risk the process of internationalization. The International Business Accelerator, or as we like to call it, the IBA, is a program built on the three principles of skills and knowledge, mentoring and accountability, and community. I built it especially for founders and CEOs who want to take their business to the next level and are wondering where to start. The program is structured in a way that's simple to follow. It's digital, so you can take part from anywhere in the world. It's a lot of fun and our members love it. So if that's you, if you're thinking about going global, check it out at internationalbusinessaccelerator.com.